Welcome, everyone, to the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast. I am your host, Jimmy Traina. Thanks for listening. Good show today. We've got a great interview with Sean McDonough, who was just named the lead NHL play-by-play voice for ESPN. And we discuss that as well as Sean's pretty unbelievable career, everything from calling the World Series, Monday Night Football, the Olympics. We get into it all, discuss why Sean thinks it didn't work out with him in Monday Night Football. He did 2 years with John Gruden. We discuss if Sean feels like he gets credit for being an elite play-by-play man, and he shares a tremendous Bull Raftery story towards the end of the pod. So make sure you listen for all that. Before we get to Sean, just a quick reminder, if you missed any recent episodes of the SI Media podcast, we had Chris Long, former Super Bowl champion, current podcast host last week, talked about the situation with players not wanting to be not getting vaccinated. Talked about what Carl Nassib will face in locker rooms and with teammates, and a couple of other things. 2 weeks ago, Jim Ross, AEW play-by-play man, and John Oran were on the pod. 3 weeks ago, John Wertheim. If you're a fan of the 80s, we relive 1984 and all the things that happened there. And 4 weeks ago, Stu Gatz from the Dan Le Batard Show on the SI Media podcast. All right, listen to those. Subscribe if you enjoy the pod. And I think you will like this one here with ESPN, very versatile ESPN play-by-play man, Sean McDonough. All right, joining me now, first time I've had him on, long overdue, the veteran and versatile play-by-play man for ESPN, who is now the lead voice of the NHL on ESPN, Sean McDonough. Sean, thanks for coming on.
Hi, Jimmy. Nice to be with you.
I appreciate you doing this.
Excuse me, long-time listener, first-time caller.
I appreciate that. And congrats on the new gig as the lead voice of the NHL. Before I even get into that, I was curious because I didn't see this anywhere. Are you still going to be doing college football?
Yes. Yeah, we'll be doing college football again with Todd Blackledge and our group, Todd McShay. Probably Molly McGrath on the sidelines. So really excited about that. Love college football. I love that group. You know, I think led by Josh Hoffman, our producer, and Scott Johnson, our director, you know, they've been putting out high quality work for a very long time, long before I joined their group. But we have a lot of fun. We get a great game every week, and college football is awesome. So that is definitely something that will not be going away.
All right. Glad to hear that. We can't lose that crew. That's a great crew, you and Todd.
Thank you.
Think it's good, you know, as good as it gets there. Tell me, I read that you went to ESPN and sort of pitched yourself for the NHL gig, which is pretty nice when you can do that. And then they say, yes, you know, that's always nice. What was it about? I mean, it's funny because when I saw the news, I mean, I hear your name. The first thing I think of is college football. And then I think of baseball. You had those memorable calls, Pirates, Braves, college basketball, Monday Night Football. Hockey didn't come in my brain, so it was interesting when I saw the news. Tell me what appealed to you about getting that gig.
Well, I love hockey. Did a lot of it, you know, back in the day. Obviously, I haven't done it in a while because we haven't had it for 16 years. And as I've said in a couple of interviews since they made the announcement, you can only do obviously what you have. And one of the things I love about ESPN is that we have a lot, and I enjoy the variety as much as anything else. So whenever people ask me, you know, what's your favorite sport or your favorite sport to call, I never really have an answer because I enjoy doing all of them. You know, if I had to choose, you know, based on what I've been doing lately, I would say college football, but love hockey. You know, grew up in Boston in the 60s and the heyday of Bobby Orr. You know, every kid on the block wanted to be Bobby Orr, and most of us had the poster of him flying through the air after he scored the Stanley Cup winning goal and got tripped and came for the against the St. Louis Blues. And it was really my first job out of college in the mid-80s. And when I left Syracuse, I went to Nesson when they were just starting out in New England. And my first main gig there was calling college hockey. Hockey East was a conference that had just been formed. So got to do a lot of games there. There weren't a lot of people watching at the time. Nesson was only in about 3,000 homes. You know, you wondered if anybody was watching sometimes. And obviously that's changed a lot. But was involved with the Boston Bruins, mostly in the pregame, postgame, in between periods. When the legendary Fred Cusick was doing the play-by-play, got to fill in for him a couple of times, which was a thrill. And did a lot of hockey for ESPN when we had it, the Frozen Four in NHL, and did the Olympic hockey in 98 at CBS and loved that. So it's always been a passion of mine. You know, Dan Berkery, who hired me to do the Red Sox games at Channel 38 in Boston back in 1988, called me a couple of weeks ago. He said, I really hope you get this hockey gig because I've always thought it was your best sport. And I've had other people tell me that too. So when the opportunity arose, I definitely was Jimmy, quite aggressive in reaching out. You know, I texted Jimmy Pitaro and Norrie Williamson and told them, you know, I'd like to be involved at the highest level I possibly could. And they responded favorably and it went from there.
Total hypothetical here, but if they would have said to you, we'll give you the NHL gig, but you got to give up the college football gig, what would you have done?
Oh boy. I probably would have still said yes. And I think the reason is the payoff is the Stanley Cup finals. You know, in college football, we get to do the championship game, Todd and I do, but it's on ESPN radio, which is still a blast. That's actually one of my favorite assignments of the year because I enjoy doing radio and don't have the chance to do a lot of it. But, you know, the chance to do the Stanley Cup finals, hopefully four times in the next 7 years, is something that I think would have been hard to pass up. You know, I think there are a few things. I was going to say there's nothing better in sports than the Stanley Cup playoffs. You know, and I don't even think there are many things that are as good. So I'm really looking forward to that. You know, that was the big payoff for me, is the chance to do the finals four times, hopefully. And then, as I said, in the next 7 years.
What do you make of, I mean, for those of us who cover media and are media nerds and follow this stuff, obviously hockey's ratings, popularity in America, you know, have always been sort of a narrative. And, you know, they're considered the fourth major sport. But if you're going by what the numbers say, they're not. I mean, college football would be in that mix before the NHL. I'm just curious, do you think it's just a matter of the league getting back on ESPN that's going to give it a huge boost? Or does the league need to do other things? Because I think, you know, I think you can't even quantify how big it's going to be to go from NBC Sports to ESPN. But is it as simple as that? Or do you think there's some other, what do you make about trying to increase the numbers there?
Well, I'm surprised that they're not higher, just because, you know, I love it. I think the sport has never been better in terms of the way it's played. You know, with the speed, they made some rules changes in recent years, I think really helped, you know, the trap, which was not very attractive and appealing, I think, from a spectator standpoint, has gone away. You know, the players are so big, strong, fast, skilled, that I'm surprised the ratings are what they are. I do think NBC has done a fantastic job. I think they've set a really high bar for us to try to get over. And a lot of them will be at Turner, some of them at our place too, helping our coverage. But, you know, I just think, to your point, Jimmy, the volume of what we're able to do at ESPN, because we are 24/7 and we have all these different networks and platforms, you know, we are going to be able to give the sport a lot more exposure than it's had in recent years. So I think that'll help. I think we have a lot. You saw the press release. I'm sure you probably talked to a few of the people who are part of this group. You know, Norby and Mark Gross and Mike McQuaid did a phenomenal job assembling, I think, a really talented team that will do a great job of being passionate and enthusiastic about the sport and hopefully helping to grow the game. Because I do think it's a great product. I don't know why more people aren't coming to it, but hopefully they will. That's our part of our job.
I mentioned the list of sports and leagues you've called. I didn't even touch. I mean, you know, obviously golf and tennis are in the mix. You've done that as well. Olympics.
Don't forget about the bobsled and luge. Perhaps my final trick was the bobsled.
How long did it take you to learn the rules for the bobsled?
It took quite a while. You know, I did it.
Yeah, I can imagine.
In 94 when I was at CBS. It was in Albertville and Lillehammer, and I actually went to Lake Placid and spent several days up at the bobsled and luge, you know, training headquarters to meet the people and have people explain to me the sport. They're really not that complicated. I mean, you lie down on a sled and try not to move at all. You know, they told me the best loser would be a dead person, right? Because the more you fight it, you know, the more you kind of slow the sled down. So if you could just be a blob and go down the mountain, that would be the best way to go. But that was really a fun experience too. But I enjoyed the hockey more in Nagano in 98.
I'm sure the hockey was a little more exciting than the luge, but I mean, it's funny because you say Lillehammer, and I think of one thing and one thing only, which is you know, Nancy Kerrigan, Tonya Harding. So since you were there, I'm just curious, since you brought it up, what do you remember about that?
And yeah, that it was a big deal, obviously. And, you know, I was particularly interested in it, being from Boston. You know, Nancy Kerrigan was very popular, you know, all across the country, particularly in the Boston area, because that's where she's from, just north of Boston. So had always kind of rooted for her. So, I, you know, felt like a, most people felt terrible for her. But, you know, when you do the bobsled and luge, your airtime is really dependent upon the performance of the Americans, right? If the Americans do well, then right. you're going to, you know, you might get on. If they don't, it's a 4-minute highlight package. So unfortunately, in those years, it was some 4-minute highlight packages, but it was still fun to do. I just remember Lillehammer was probably the coldest I've ever been in my life. I think where we were in Hunderfossen, which is where the bobsled and luge was, I don't think it ever got above zero Fahrenheit, even during the day, the whole time right. that we were there. So it was really cold. And my other recollection is that Vendela, who at the time was the Sports Illustrated swimsuit cover model, was staying in our hotel, which you know, got everybody's attention, and a lovely person. Yes. We actually got to know each other a little bit, spent some time together. She was very nice.
The one thing I've learned over the years from working at SI, when you're in the building and the swimsuit model,
she was there for Sports Illustrated. Actually, she was there, you know, schmoozing advertisers and clients, and
right.
And they were happy.
The thing about the models is you know who they are right away because they're all so tall.
Yes.
It's impossible not to know which ones are the other.
But I remember mostly she was super nice. You know, she was just a regular person who happens to be blessed, unlike some of us.
Yes. You can tell me about it. It's funny because if listeners to this podcast and if regular readers of my column, I have an obsession with like the sports things. If they took place during Twitter, and Nancy Kerrigan and Tonya Harding would be a top five event with if that took place during Twitter and the internet, it would have been quite the story. I brought up the sports you covered. So have you never done an NBA game? Or did you do any at CBS back in the day?
I did a couple Celtics games locally, filling in when people got sick. But I've never done an NBA game for ESPN.
It's probably you have any desire to
sports I have.
Yeah.
Maybe just to say I did all of them. You know, the other day when Katina Arnold, who you know from the ESPN PR, was putting together the press release, you know, when I read it, I was struck by the variety of things I've been blessed to do. And again, it kind of goes back to what I said about having been at ESPN, where we have so much. But, you know, when I was at CBS, had a chance to do the Olympics, which obviously you couldn't have done at ESPN, and a chance to do the Masters and the PGA Championship. Done the PGA Championship now since I've been at ESPN. But, you know, to have done basically all the major sports and some of the other things we talked about, and the all four golf majors, which I love. I'm passionate about golf. You know, just feel like I've been really fortunate to do a really wide variety of things.
I know you said that when people ask you your favorite sport to call, you don't have an answer. But I'm curious about two things. What has been your all-time single favorite game or event that you
have
called?
It's a great question. I would say, I think you referenced it earlier, Game 7 of the 1992 National League Championship Series between the Pirates and the Braves. You know, MLB Network did a series. I think it was baseball's greatest games or something like that. And they picked the top, whatever, 30, 40, 50 games of all time. And I believe it was number 4. And if anything, that might've been too low. You know, I remember talking to Steve Hurd from the Elias Sports Bureau, who obviously is an authority on all these sorts of things. And he said, you can make an argument, was the greatest game, you know, baseball game of all time, just because of, you know, what it meant. Game 7, you know, Atlanta was the favorite. Pittsburgh led 2-0. You know, there was so many things that went into the bottom of the ninth that were unlikely, including Francisco Cabrera getting the hit, who barely played in the major leagues that season. So, you know, dramatic ending. You kind of knew that it was the last hurrah for the Pittsburgh Pirates with that group with Barry Bonds and others was going to break up. A lot of really weird things that happened behind the scenes. You know, that was the night Tim McCarver got into the episode with Deion Sanders in the locker room after the game. We were told after the game that our producer, who had produced the whole season of Major League Baseball and CBS with us, was not going to go to the World Series for a variety of reasons. I thought I'd kind of botched the call. It was probably the first of my infamous voice cracks, which, by the way, thank you for writing not too long ago that it was maybe the most underappreciated thing in sports. I was going to bring that up. They read that. And I appreciate that. You know, at the beginning that night, that was really the first one that I remember.
Right.
And, you know, it was just so loud. Most of the time, it's just a product of it. It's so loud. You know, there's a reason why, you know, singers wear those earpieces or whatever. You know, you need to be able to hear yourself. Really to control your voice. And it was just so loud in the old Atlanta Fulton County Stadium. What I remember was I was feeling like I was holding on to the desk in the booth, and it felt like the stadium was shaking. I mean, it was that loud. And but I kind of thought I had botched the call. And then
why did you think you botched it? What made you think you botched it?
My voice kind of cracked a little bit. It was safe. And then but, you know, I had friends in the booth. Billy Andrade is the professional golfer. He's on the Champions Tour now. He's a longtime friend. He's another New Englander and Red Sox fan. And he and his wife, Jody, lived in Atlanta. They were in the back of our booth. And, you know, when we got finished, because we had to do the post game for quite a while, we're walking down and the stadium's just about empty. And I remember saying to them, like, oh, my God, that might be the biggest play I ever call in my life. And at the time, I was 30 years old. So I was, you know, new in my at the network level. And when I got down to the truck, the reaction was just the opposite. The people were coming up to me and hugging me and high-fiving me and telling me, you know, that was so perfect. You're going to play that call forever. And you really nailed it. And that matched the moment. And you know, when I hear it back now, I've come to that opinion that, you know, whatever your call is, it should reflect the magnitude of the moment, right? The play and what it means. And in that case, the unlikelihood, if that's a wordness of it. You know, same thing with the Michigan State, you know, ending of that football game. It was just, you know, so unlikely and so bizarre, you know, and the strangest, you know, most surprising ending of a game I've ever done. So, you know, with the passage of time now, I've come to appreciate it. And I used to get, I don't say embarrassed about the voice crack thing, but now it's, you know, it's, I can't make myself do it. So you know,
when it does happen,
I'm doing it on purpose, but
right. When it does happen, what goes like afterwards now, are you like, oh, there it goes again? Or are you hard on yourself?
Embarrassing was the playoff game that we did. John Gruden and I did.
Was that Chiefs Titans?
Kansas City. There was actually a touchdown that called back. So the play didn't even count.
Right.
But that one, I had been sick the whole week. Matter of fact, when we got to Kansas City a couple of days before the game, I couldn't even talk, and to the point where they were making plans for, you know, contingency plans. And the Kansas City Chiefs doctor pumped me full of all kinds of medication. And, you know, he didn't know what it was. It was allergies or some sort of virus or whatever. So I was basically taking everything, and I still wasn't feeling great. And, you know, you're conscious, and it's a horrible feeling, right? It's the biggest game you're going to do the whole year. I mean, you do the whole season to get the chance to do this one playoff game. And, but I was kind of almost feeling like I was conserving it, you know, not really pushing it on big plays, you know, almost intentionally trying to be low key, which I kind of am a lot anyway. But the, so, you know, that I think was more a byproduct of, I had no limited voice to start with.
Right.
So, but that one was really embarrassing. You know, if I could get on YouTube and erase that having never happened, I'd take that one back. But the rest of them I'm fine with.
I can't believe you just said that. Cause I have to admit, when I did that piece about that column about your voice crack being underappreciated, and I went to look up some of the famous ones, that's the most prevalent one that's on YouTube by far.
Yeah, well, that one.
So don't be embarrassed, because even if
but that was just. Yeah. I mean, I probably shouldn't have even been doing the game.
But don't be but don't regret it. People loved it. People loved it, whether the play counted or not.
People say that all the time. For everybody who, you know, so he's the voice crack guy, like it's a negative. To me,
no,
like that Michigan State play, and not to be self indulgent here, but I think it's part of the reason why people remember it as vividly as they do. And I'm sorry if that sounds self-absorbed. I don't mean it to be. I try
no. Listen,
make it about myself when I do a game. You know, I try very hard to do that because it's not about me or the other broadcasters. Right. It's, people tune in to watch the game. My family may care, but other than that, I never know on these Zooms where the camera is. I'm looking at you over here.
No, it's all good. Well, I'll be self-absorbed for a moment.
I've stopped wearing the one that you wrote about was the Gonzaga, half-court shot.
Right.
And the interesting thing about that, Jimmy, was I was in Charlotte. The Final Four was in Indianapolis. But Dick Vitale and I were doing that remotely. So I was in the ESPN studio in Charlotte in a room that was not much bigger than a broom closet, right? So you have there aren't that many people in there anyway. You get a little bit of the crowd through what they're feeding you from Indianapolis. But, I'm trying to call this memorable, one of the great plays in the history of the Final Four, literally, doing it from your home office, and I'm standing up and screaming, watching it on the monitor. So I hope it adds to people's enjoyment of the play. As I said, I don't do it on purpose. If I could, I don't know if I would or not, but I probably wouldn't, right? But it doesn't bother me. It used to be a little embarrassing, but now it's just when it happens, it happens.
Yeah.
And I get this, he's the voice crack guy. I think it's happened. Like, I've done thousands of games. It's probably happened 5 times, but you're the voice crack guy.
It's a big moment it's a big moment when the voice cracks.
Underappreciated.
It's not happening on a 3-yard run.
Michigan State people come up to me all the time. And a lot of them can do every word of that play verbatim. I've seen t-shirts that were made that has the call word for word. Somebody took a picture in a restroom in some restaurant in East Lansing. It was a poster on the wall, everything. He has trouble with the snap and the ball is free, blah, blah, blah. So, hopefully it just helps people remember dramatic moments a little more than they otherwise might have.
I'll always remember that moment because I'll be self-absorbing here. Every year, me and I have two buddies who come to my house every single year for one Saturday of the college football season. And we watch games and bet every game basically on the board from noon to midnight. And we all had, I think, Michigan State in that game. So we will never forget that as long as we live, my friend Dan.
What I was really proud of is Chris Spielman really set the whole thing up. And I loved working with him. To me, he's just like Todd. It's never about him, Todd Blackledge. They're football guys, they grew up the sons of football coaches, been around it their whole life. They have a great appreciation for players and coaches. And obviously they're both great players, but it's never about them. And Chris kept saying, all they need to do is get the punt off. There's nobody back there. Just get it off. The only thing that can happen is, what happened. And then, the play ended and our producer and director, Bo Garrett, and I believe Mike Schwab was our director, did such a good job. Those are those moments that, and I think we all kind of learned this from Vin Scully, who was kind of notorious for it. Don't say anything, just stop talking. He used to talk about, he'd actually get up and go away from the microphone to avoid the temptation to say anything. That Francisco Cabrera play, I don't think we said anything for a minute or more, maybe, because there's nothing you can say. And the pictures of, especially of that one, Michigan student, I guess, with this look on his face of utter disbelief. Yeah. I was really proud of the job our technical crew and our the rest of the group did that day too.
That was an all-timer.
And our spotter, Zach Rapapazon, our spotter, to nail Jalen Watts Jackson, who was a pretty obscure, he was like a second or third string safety, immediately, because there's nothing worse on a play like that than, and Smith goes in and scores the game when he touched. No, it's Jones.
Right.
That play is going to live forever, and your terrible call is going to live with it too if you get the wrong guy. So Zach is so great, but it's when you work with a spotter that long that when he's pointing that enthusiastically at number 20, he has the right guy. Because sometimes the punt will get blocked, and you can't really see the number . You want to make sure you got the right guy, or the guy picks it up and he's running for the touchdown. Is that number what, so sometimes, a lot of times, he's not sure. And then in the call, you kind of fill the time, I do. I always tell Zach, please don't tell me unless you're sure. Because on TV, especially, you can fill the time till you get it right by talking about, he's at the 20, he's at the 10, whatever. but you want to make sure you have the right person. And Zach just completely nailed that.
It's funny, over the years of interviewing play-by-play folks, I always, if someone comes on who calls multiple sports like yourself, I always ask the most difficult to call. And almost everybody says college football because of the numbers and the names. Curious what your take is.
Yeah, if I was the czar of all sports, double numbers would be a thing of the past. You know, you can't have two number sixes, you know, and I've had the wrong call. And a lot of times, you know, they look the same, right? Because they play the same, you know, one for wide receiver, the other guy's a defensive back. So, you know, it's not like, okay, that must be number six, the wide receiver, because the other number six is defensive tackle. That doesn't usually happen. So, you know, and then if they don't have names on their backs, you know, sometimes with binoculars or whatever. It's part of it is, you know, in your preparation, you kind of need to know who the people are who are on special teams, because it's usually in those situations when the confusion happens. I mean, you know, one number six is a wide receiver, the other guy's defensive back. So if it's when they're on offense or defense, you pretty much know which number six it is. But double numbers are horrible. And then the size of the numbers now, I mean, the NCAA actually made a rule that, you know, the numbers have to be visible, because a lot of these schools were going to numbers that basically blended into their uniform. You couldn't see any number.
Right.
And and then you're into this, Jimmy, but most people probably won't care. You know, you're into the inner workings of this. A really horrible trend in a lot of college campuses has been the broadcast booth has been moved to a really bad place. You know, Ole Miss, they made the one of the suites near us a lot bigger. And our booth, we could only stand three across. So it's me, the analyst, and you have to make the choice. Do you want the spotter there or the stats person? Because there's really only room for three. And the other person has to be behind. It's crazy. That small. And a lot of them have gotten moved really far away or at a terrible angle.
What's the one school? What is it? Is it Washington, where you're basically in the clouds, right? Is it?
Yeah, I haven't been there. Well, I was there a couple of years ago. They changed the press box there. It's really far back, but I don't remember it being terrible. But you know, I was starting to say Miami in the Dolphins Stadium, where they played the college football national championship game this year. We were in the end zone, the corner of the end zone. So the goal line's here, and the rest of the field's this way. We were 20 yards further at an angle. So anything beyond like the 40-yard line closest to us, you had to call off a TV screen. I mean, it was COVID. There weren't that many people there. There were a million places they could put you. You know, a lot of times the broadcast booth has been moved. You know, the old Boston Guard were talking about broadcasting hockey. One of my favorite things to do was the old Beanpot hockey tournament, which I don't know if you're familiar with, but it's the four Division I schools in Boston. They play the first two Monday nights in February, BC, BU, Harvard, and Northeastern. And, you know, the winners play the next Monday night, and the losers play in the consolation game. But it's a big deal in Boston. But the old broadcast booth at the old Boston Garden was in the front row of the balcony, which basically hung over center ice. I mean, you could hear the players talking to each other. I mean, you were that close. And then when they knocked down the building and built the new TV garden, you know, the broadcast booth went to the ninth floor. And I remember asking one of the Bruins people, why are the booths up on the roof? I said, well, you know, those suites, we get a lot of down below on the third or fourth, fifth level. We get a lot of money for those. Like, well, how much money do you get from the TV rights holders? And they we actually need to see the game. You know, a lot of those people down there are having a cocktail and a shrimp and, you know, that are talking to each other. And, oh, there was a goal. Who scored? Oh, is the TV on? Or can I watch the replay? You know, so while the broadcasters are down there looking straight down, trying to identify people. So that's a bad trend. You know, the broadcast booths have gotten moved to a bad place in favor of luxury suites where people half pay attention to the game anyway.
Yeah. Yeah,
Did that sound whiny? Because if it does, I apologize.
No, the people in the suites don't care.
One of the things I've learned, like, nobody cares about our problem. You know,
right.
I hate
that's true.
When people talk about how long the game was or, you know, I missed my flight last night or blah, blah, blah. People don't care. Nor should they.
I care because I'm into, like, the daily minutia of life and the struggles that we all go through. So complaining is a pro for me. But you know, I know a lot of people don't want to hear it. I want, you mentioned the Titans and the Chiefs and getting to call that playoff game. You did Monday Night Football for 2 years. I guess it would be fair to say it didn't work out. Looking back, anything stand out to you about why it didn't work out? What, anything you'd do differently?
Well, yeah, we could probably do a half hour just on this. I don't know how much time you have.
Let's go.
You know, when I got hired, I remember thinking, matter of fact, I called Chris Spielman, who I've been working with prior to that. And he was one of the first people I called after my family, they offered to me. And I said to him, I just took the Monday Night Football job and I'm feeling like, I wonder if I made a mistake. I love college football. And he said, oh no, you didn't make a mistake. It's Monday Night Football. You have to do it. And of course you have to do it. Right. And I'm glad that I did say yes. And I'm glad I did it. You know, when I was hired, part of what I was instructed to do was to try to make it more conversational, make it, you know, a little lighter, bring out more of John Gruden's personality that, you know, you used to see from time to time, excuse me, on that quarterback show that he did, QB camp. Mm-hmm. When he'd do a half hour, you know, they did a half hour special with all the quarterback prospects and, you know, get into more storytelling, which is something that I've done a lot of in college football. That's one of the reasons I really enjoy doing college football. There's much more storytelling. For the most part, you know, people watching don't know much about the players. Whereas, you know, when you're watching an NFL game, you really don't want to know, but Tom Brady has a stamp collection or something, you know, so it's really not a part of the presentation. So, but I think, to be totally candid, you know, John Gruden enjoyed the X and O part of it. You know, I call this play 96 Wanda, blah, blah, blah. And he loved to telestrate. And he told me when I first got the job, I don't like stories, you know, but he didn't want the stories and he didn't really want to engage in conversation. You know, there were times when I would ask him a question or make a point where he didn't respond. And I think it was just because he was so focused on, I'm going to diagram this play. And he just didn't want to do it. So there were times when I think it came across as being awkward. And it was awkward. It was awkward for me. You know, you're standing there next to somebody wondering, you know, if I ask him a question about this, is he going to answer it? Or is he going to be annoyed that I asked him? Or so it was, you know, it was uncomfortable. The part of, you know, now the part of it that bothered me was, you know, the narrative from some people in your line of work. Oh, well, that was a little too big for McDonough. You know, I did the World Series when I was 30. I don't think anybody thought I was nervous or out of place. Maybe a few people did, you know, I've done all these other events that we talked about. It wasn't that I felt like that I was nervous, you know, oh, this is Monday Night Football. Or this is, you know, a big gig. I'm not sure I'm capable of this, you know. I think if we had, and again, this is not meant to be critical of John Gruden. I mean, he was great at that aspect of it. It's what he wanted to do. It's what the producer and director, you know, that's when you're putting up the replays, he needs to talk about them. You know, it was the direction that they chose to go in most of the time, which I understand. You know, John's the analyst. TV's an analyst-driven medium. That was his strength. They played his strengths. It made sense. But, you know, it just didn't match with what I thought I was there to do and what I had typically done in my career to earn the opportunity to be there. You know, I'm used to interacting with Bill Raftery and Jay Billis. I think if I was sitting there with them, I don't think people's perception would have been, well, this is too big of a, or he's not meant to do this. You know what I mean? So
right.
Again, not meaning to be critical of Gruden or anybody else. I understand why it went the way it did, but I just think it was not a great dynamic based on his strengths, my strengths, and kind of the way the broadcast went.
It wasn't great,
but you know, I'm glad I had the chance to do it. But did I think we were bad? No, I thought it was fine, but it could have been great in my opinion. And it wasn't.
Did you ever have a moment during a game or any time in year one or year two where it hit you like, oh, this isn't working, or, you know, that we're not meshing?
The first night there was one or two, first game we did was in Washington. Steelers and Washington. And there were one or two times where I said something that I expected would elicit a response and it didn't. And I just thought to the point where I thought he didn't hear me. And, you know, Mike Tirico, I talked to Mike, you know, Mike had was my predecessor. He's a really good friend back to the Syracuse days. We kind of overlapped. He was coming in just as I was leaving, but you know, we've been friends since the mid 80s. And one of the things after when I talked to him was, he said, you need, when you're going to, if you're going to address something to John, you need to make sure that you have his attention, because he does do the replays a lot. He's a lot of times he's in conversation with the truck, as you know, and probably people listen to this are probably into broadcasting, but we have buttons on our headset where we can talk to the truck, the producer, the director, the graphics people, whomever, it's an intercom, and we can say, hey, nothing happens after this play. Can you get a shot of the coach? I want to tell that story about blah, blah, blah. So that's why a lot of times it's really in sync, because the talkback button is a really important tool. And John used it exceedingly well. But a lot of times you don't know if someone's talking in the other guy's ear or the other woman, the woman's ear, if you're working with a woman. So, so I think there were times when actually I was saying something to him and someone else was talking in his ear. So that's going to happen. That happens with everybody.
Yeah.
But I've had it happen to me where someone is, an analyst is saying something to me that they expect their response and the producer's talking here and you just didn't even hear it. So there were a number of times when it was uncomfortable. And it crossed that way. I don't think anybody who watched it would be surprised to hear me say that.
Was there ever a conversation
I'm taking my share of the blame for the parts that they didn't go well, because it's a collaborative effort. And as I said, I don't think it was terrible, but I think it could have been better.
I'm curious about one thing.
I don't like the narrative that somehow was too big for me, because I've done other things just as many people, if not more. I'm not I'm not nervous. I've worked with a lot of people who get nervous before they go on the air. I'm not one of those people. Todd Blackledge and I, if anything, are probably laughing too much in the moments leading up to the open. So, that's the only part of it that bothers me. But I'm really grateful for the opportunity, Jimmy, because, when I got it, I mean, it's still Monday Night Football. I think you make the argument it's the most iconic franchise in sports TV. It's not what it once was. It couldn't be. Right now, we have Sunday Night Football and Thursday Night Football, and, every game's on Sunday, and all these college games are on every night of the week. It doesn't stand there mostly alone like it used to, but it's still special. I was really moved by, when we go to the player and coaches meetings. I remember Jameis Winston, we did a game at Tampa Bay, talking about how, I've grown up my whole life dreaming about playing on Monday Night Football. So, it's still special when for the people who are on it. And it was special for me to be, I was the fifth play-by-play person in 47 years. The others were Keith Jackson, Frank Gifford, Al Michaels, Mike Tirico. Just to be included in that group was pretty awesome, and still is.
I'm curious about one thing you said. You said that as soon as you accepted the job, you called Chris Spielman and said, did I make a mistake? What made you
have that? Well, I loved college football, and I knew I was going to miss college football. And I did miss it. Saturdays, we'd go visit the home team on Saturday when I was doing Monday Night Football. So we'd go to their practice facility, watch practice if they had one, and then meet with players and coaches. And then we'd see the visiting team on Sunday when they got to their hotel. And, invariably, as you're walking through these buildings, football buildings or even the hotels, whatever, catch a college football game and you'd see, 85,000 people at Clemson going crazy. And you'd think, I really missed that. There is an atmosphere. There's a color and pageantry about college football that's different from the NFL. NFL is much, I think the NFL is great. I watch it. I'm a fan, but the atmosphere is different. There's more build up to the game, all the traditions on these various campuses.
It's funny.
Not the same.
It's funny because what I remember about that 2-year run you had there, I mean, listen, you would know it because you lived it. I don't remember if someone says to me, Sean McDonough, Monday Night Football, I don't think of the narrative that anyone thought you weren't big enough for it. I do remember, weren't there a lot of, I don't want to use the word controversy because that's really strong, but maybe there's a little blowback because you would hammer the officials sometimes. And I don't know, did you ever get heat from the NFL or from ESPN?
Yeah, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt.
No, that's okay.
No, I mean, no one at ESPN ever said, hey, you need to back off. I definitely, and no one from the league ever directly said anything to me. But you kind of get the sense that the league wasn't happy about the narrative. The ending of my tenure at Monday Night with Monday Night Football was strange because, when I got the job, the Monday Night Football job, John Skipper was president of ESPN. And John Wildhack was basically, you know, the number two. And John kind of hired me, John Wildhack, and then he left very shortly thereafter to go to be the athletic director at the Harvard of Central New York, Syracuse University. And at the end of our second season, you'll remember this, ESPN convened a big powwow. They asked all the talent, all different sports to come to Bristol. And they basically gave us a pep talk. You know, it was John Skipper and Connor Schell. And because the narrative around then was that, you know, ESPN was kind of on the slide. And you know, they actually did a great job of telling us, you know, don't believe it. We're not going to lose this property. And matter of fact, we're going to bid on that. We're going to try to get this and blah, blah, blah. And, you know, the future's bright and Disney's doing fine. And so I think, and then I saw Skipper on the way out and he kind of patted me on the back and said, you know, you're doing a great job, blah, 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 blah. And I left there really feeling good. And then a week later, he resigned. Within days of that, John Gruden announces he's leaving and going back to coaching. So no one really knew exactly who was in charge. You know, we had several management people who all had kind of similar levels and titles. They brought the great George Bodenheimer back, but he was just, you know, there to make sure the building didn't catch on fire. You know, he didn't want to make decisions like that by his own admission. And he is the greatest of the great. You know, if you talk about all the people you've met in this job, you know, who do you admire the most? He would be, there's nobody I admire more than him. But especially for what he's doing now with the V Foundation. He's just such a good charitable guy more than anything else. But the, so anyway, at that playoff game we talked about earlier, which is Gruden's last game, another, you know, strange, bizarre thing, because, you know, I wished him well in the opening. You know, we kind of felt like, well, we need to address this. And then he wouldn't even admit that he was going to be the coach of the Raiders in the open. Well, you know, nothing's been decided yet. We're like, what? So that was bizarre in and of itself.
Yeah, but, for sure.
But the narrative then from these two or three people who were kind of all seemed to be involved in decision-making was, we're going to go out and, you know, get you the perfect partner. And, you know, we want to make it more storytelling, blah, 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 blah. And, you know, this will kind of give us the opportunity to do that. So, right. But then I think the more they looked at it, the more they thought, you know what, this is kind of a change to opportunity to hit the whole reset button. Matter of fact, none of the, you know, Jay Rothman's not producing anymore. I think Lisa's the only person who's kind of still there among the talent, and the Lisa Salters, who's awesome.
I don't want to put you in an awkward situation.
But Chip Dean's not directing anymore. Jay Rothman's not. Yeah. I think it was kind of a part of the process. So, you know, when it was obvious that they might replace the play-by-play person too, you know, I was certainly open to it. You know, I really missed college football. Matter of fact, I've mentioned Zach, who was on our spotter a couple of times. When I called him, tell him we were going back, he said, good, we used to have fun. So we are having fun. So
there you go.
It's the right thing for me. You know, I was always appreciate having had the opportunity. And as I said, it's a great honor to be included in that company and have been a part of that package. But I'm in the right place for me.
At least you didn't have to work with an analyst who they put on a crane. But I don't want you to respond to that because that would not be nice to you. But that really was the most bizarre thing ever.
I hate the reasons of that. That was after my time.
Yeah. I hate to sort of.
I will say this. I think they've put together a really nice booth now. Yeah, I think Steve and Brian and Lewis are doing a really good job. And I'm glad that they've stuck with them. You know, I think any booth takes time, especially, you know, like, you know, let's talk about working with John Gruden. You know, you're doing one game a week. I mean, I did 39 games, I think, with him total. That's not a lot, you know.
No.
you do learn kind of the rhythm and timing and their likes and dislikes, but that takes time. So I'm glad they've stuck with the group. And I'm really glad that Steve's going to be a huge part of our hockey coverage too, because obviously he's a great hockey person and loves it.
Huge.
I think when he comes on the air to start, you know, the Stanley Cup Finals is our host, that will just add to the big time feel of it. Kind of like when I see Tirico on these NBC events as the host, you know, when Mike's involved, it feels big.
Two more. I'm curious, you know, I mentioned some of the, you know, we just touched on the things you've called. You obviously did the World Series for CBS, Monday Night Football, the college football. I mean, everything now in it. But do you ever feel sort of I mean, I mentioned the underappreciated voice crack, but do you ever feel like underappreciated as sort of the elite play-by-play people? You know, you always hear this, you know, you always hear about Joe Buck and Jim Nantz. It feels like you should be in that conversation. Do you ever think about that? I mean, listen, we all have egos in this business, so it's, you know, only natural, but I'm just curious if how much that gets on your mind.
Well, there must be something about your question asking, because I've talked about a lot of these subjects before, but I've never delved into them as much as I have these
things. I appreciate that.
You know, for the longest time, I was labeled underrated so often that I almost thought being underrated was overrated, right? I mean, you know, it's right. Like almost every reference in print by a lot of people whose opinion I really appreciate, you know. So I appreciated that. You know, to be totally honest, yes, you know, I think based on the volume of things I've done, and I hope I've done at a high level, that you would like to have your name be mentioned in that list. I appreciate it. You just said it. But what I appreciate more than anything is that among the people you mentioned, I know they view me that way. You know, Reese Davis has said to me many times, you're the best play-by-play guy there is in on any network in any sport. And he said, when I got started doing football games, I watched you. And, you know, when I got the hockey gig, I had text messages from Jim Nantz, from Marv Albert, from Mike Tirico, Kevin Harlan, Joe Buck, all saying the same thing. Like, you deserve, Mike Green, you know, you deserve this. We're happy for you. Yeah, I mean, do I spend a lot of time thinking about it? No. Would I like to be mentioned among those same people? Sure, I would be. You know, and maybe this hockey is another chance to do it. I mean, Mike Emmerich, you know, hockey, as you talked about the ratings, wasn't the highest rated sport when he was doing it. And he was voted the national sportscaster of the year by us, you know, the people in the National Sports Media Association, more than once. And I voted for him more than once. I think I voted for him every time that he won it. So, you know, I think this is another opportunity to hopefully demonstrate that I can do an exciting sport at a high level. But I care more about what my peers think, honestly, because I think, I hope this doesn't sound the wrong way, you know, we know better than anybody else, right? What goes into doing it and what goes into doing it well or poorly or whatever. So I've always felt like I had respect of my peers and appreciation of my peers, and people in your business, like you, Richard Deitch, you know, the people who do it at the highest level. You know, I like Phil Mushnick. You know, he's a taste, you know, for some people, but I probably like him because he's been exceedingly nice to me. Matter of fact, my dad,
you're the only one.
We ran into Mushnick somewhere years ago. This had to be a long time. My dad's been gone for 18 and a half years, but the matter of fact, yesterday would have been my dad's 86th birthday, which was still an emotional thing. But
I used to love your dad on the NBC pregame show, giving the information.
That was when I was
that's when, like, you got information
money to pay for Syracuse.
And that was when you got information from the pregame show.
My dad one time, there must be something wrong with your kid because I like him.
You're the only one. You're the only one.
Yeah, but the anyway. So, you know,
well, listen,
I appreciate it, but I don't get hung up on it. I'm sorry, but that's a really long.
Obviously, listen, your resume is second to none, and best or play-by-play announcer is a subjective thing. But I will say you're the smartest play-by-play announcer because you're not on Twitter.
Right,
and that is
a
brilliant decision.
Guard against myself. First of all, I don't care. You know, my sister. Used to say on Monday Night Football, you know, I said, just unless somebody threatens to kill me, I really don't want to know what they said. And then, but my sister works in the PR business, so she has to be on social media all the time for a job. And so she used to say to me, well, the people who are saying nice things about you have 250,000 followers, and the people who are saying you suck have 6. So, you know, I hope that's, you know, people are entitled to their opinion. I just don't care. And what it really is, Jimmy, is a defense against myself. You know,
I would fire back
at somebody, hey, you know, blah, blah, blah. So I just do it really to prevent. And I don't, I have seen so many people who do what we do get bothered by it while they're on there. You know, they'll check their mentions and then they'll read something. And I've heard people respond to something that was said on Twitter on the air and not mention, I'm responding to this on Twitter, but it was almost like, you think I was too hard on the Bears defense. So now I'm going to say something nice about the Bears defense. You know, you can't.
Crazy.
Letting it affect what you say during the game. That's a big mistake.
You're very smart to not be on there. Last thing, and I asked this of anybody who has ever worked with the guy, and you worked with him for a long time. I need a Bill Raftery story.
Oh gosh.
Give me anything. Anything late night drinking, anything at the bars, anything.
Well, I could write a book just about Bill and my time with Bill. You know, I worked with Bill for a very long time, and then Jay Billis joined us, and that made it even more fun. Of all the booths I've been in, I think I've worked with 160 different analysts. I keep a list of all the analysts, the sideline report producers, directors, and it's pages and pages. But
I'm not gonna ask you for a name, but do you have a single favorite?
Well, there's nobody better than Raf. There's no better person than Raf, right? I mean, and I think the other people who I've worked with would understand why I picked him over them, because everybody feels that way about him. You know,
right.
Jim O'Connell, the great sports writer who I think worked for the AP for 100 years, wrote an article one time about Raf, and he was asking me for a couple of quotes. And I just said, if you don't like Bill Raftery, there's something wrong with you. Now, you may not like his style on the air. You know, as you were still talking about earlier, it's subjective. Nobody has 100% approval rating or popularity.
I think only Vin Scully is the only one ever would be Vin.
Right.
Has 100% approval rating.
Yeah. I would say the same thing. Like, if you didn't like Vin Scully's broadcasting, there's probably something wrong with you. But that's the way I feel about Bill as a person. Yeah. I still talk with him two or three times a week. It's amazing how many times I'm somewhere at a charity golf thing or at a restaurant with somebody, and someone asked me about Raf, and we wind up FaceTiming him, and you know, he's just the best. I think I've told this story before. When it was three of us, you know, we kind of used to like to be the first one who could bust on one of the other guys or both of the other guys, and usually you had to do it in the on-cam opening, because you know, the gloves were coming off in a respectful, humorous way, hopefully. So one time we were in we're at Notre Dame doing a Saturday night game, and we had all arrived separately, had our own rental cars, and then we were doing a big Monday up at Marquette, which was maybe a 3-hour drive, I don't know, more or less. So we decided we'll drive up together. Billis, as usual, had the nicest car, because you know, he's big time. And I say that lovingly and in jest. But so he had like an SUV. So anyway, we decide, okay, we're going to meet in front of the hotel Sunday morning at 10 o'clock. We'll all drive to the little local South Bend airport down the road, and we'll dump two cars and jump in and go. So as I'm coming out, there's Jay, always on time. As a matter of fact, always early. He's already pulling out of the garage. It's freezing cold. It had been snowing. Bill, I'm getting my car. Bill is walking around the parking lot with the key thing like this, looking at all these, you know, it's a hotel parking. All the cars look the same, right? They're all lawnmower rental cars. So I get in, I'm pulling out. Bill is still going up and down every row, and it's freezing. I said, Bill, get in. So, you know, what are we looking for? I don't know. It's white. It's a, you know, it's a Taurus or whatever it was. So we drive by every car. I said, by any chance, when you got here Thursday night, did you have a couple pops at dinner at Parisi's and leave your car? Have somebody bring you back? Yes. So we take him to the Italian restaurant. His car is covered in ice and snow. I mean, you couldn't even, you couldn't get the key in the lock. It was iced over. And you were sitting there trying to bang it. So, to the point about, you know, being the first one to kind of hammer the other guys. And a lot of times it was just totally an inside joke, which is probably really unprofessional. But we come on the air Monday night. Welcome to Marquette, blah, blah, blah. It's Connecticut and Marquette. I'm Sean McDonough, along with Jay Billis, and the star of Dude, Where's My Car, Bill Raftery. You know, it's like no one has any idea what that means. But,
right.
You know, we did. That's all.
That is an inside joke.
But just the
best. That's tremendous.
This person I know, you know, loved by everybody. When he got the Final Four gig, you know, as I say to him all the time, nobody's accomplished more in their 80s than you, Bill. I mean, which is a joke. I think he was in his early 70s. But But, you know, to get that opportunity, I was so happy for him. He wins the Sports Emmy. You know, it's like he didn't even know he won. You call him, he immediately changes the subject to something else, you know.
Right.
He's the best. I miss working with him a lot.
Yeah, that's a great story. I appreciate you
telling
that.
Have you ever had him on?
Yeah, I've had him on. I've had him on. And
I promise you that. Changes the subject so fast.
I had a great moment with him. CBS had, it was before the tournament. CBS always has like a breakfast with all the announcers play by play in Manhattan. And I was talking to him and Ian, and I said to
Riggs,
yes, for sure. And I said to Raft, is there any way you'd ever join Twitter? And he said, no. And I'll tell you why. He said, because I'm afraid I'll have 10 drinks at night and then tweet something and lose my job. Mm-hmm. And I tweeted that quote and people could not get enough of it. I mean, it was just typical, you know, it was the epitome of Bill Raftery.
But he'd have
right
a
there.
Trillion followers if he did do Twitter, but he's the best. Yeah. And, you know, just, you know, like, I'll give you an example. He does the Final Four, obviously, now with Jim and Nance and Grant Hill and Tracy Wolfson. And I've been doing the international feed. ESPN has the broadcast rights for the rest of the world. Matter of fact, that Gonzaga play was on ESPN International, was on 200 countries around the world, but not in the United States. So they get access at the Final Four to players, coaches, you know, production meetings, they sit in the room and talk. We don't, you know, sometimes we leverage our friendships with these coaches if we know them from over the years, but every year at the Final Four, Bill will take a lot of his time to sit with me and go through what every coach and every player said to them in the production meeting, strategy, biographical tidbits, injuries. And the most unbelievable example was this year, as I mentioned a long time ago now, I was doing it from Charlotte and Dick Vitale was in his home in Florida. And so I try to get a couple of the coaches and the SIDs on the phone, but you know, it's the Final Four, they're running around. So Bill and I talked the Friday night before the Saturday national semifinals, and he gave me all this information. He hadn't talked to Mark Few and Gonzaga yet. They were going to meet fairly late the night before. So he said, and I'll call you back after I talk to Few. I'm like, no, Bill, it's late. You don't have to be. Well, sure enough, you know, I've been 11 o'clock at night. Here's the phone call to go through everything that Mark Few said about the players and the strategy. So he's the best. He is absolutely the best. Yeah.
He's a character for sure.
Someday, Billis and I have talked a lot about this. You know, we'd like to write a book about it because, you know, that probably wasn't even the best. It wasn't even probably close to the best story, but on or off the air. But, and we'd like to work together again someday. You know, we're hoping that maybe CBS or Fox would let Bill come back and just do another big Monday game for the fun of it.
Because that would be,
I was never more
proud
to be a part of the group than I was that one.
Yeah, that would be a lot of fun for us. I appreciate you coming on. This was great. I really enjoyed it. And best of luck with the NHL. And glad you're still going to be doing college football.
Yeah, thank you. Me too. Love Todd Blackledge. There's another guy you should have on. I mean, you know, you talk about maybe underappreciated, underrated. We had that conversation earlier. I don't know if he is. I think most people in our business really appreciate him. But I think he's as good as any analyst in any sport. And a wonderful guy too. That's one of the things I feel so fortunate about Jimmy, was just having done all these events. You know, it's like any experience in life, it's the people who make it special. And you know, to work with people like those we've mentioned, that's the best part of the whole thing for me.
Yep. And it'll be here before you know it, a couple of months away. We'll get back into college
months
football
away, so. And then the hockey not far off beyond that. And you know, hockey people are awesome. You know, that's always been kind of the narrative. The hockey people are the nicest people. And I think that's probably true too. So really looking forward to getting back more closely into the hockey community.
All right. Have fun and enjoy it. I appreciate you coming on.
Thank you, Jimmy. Appreciate you.
Take care. Be well.
Take care.
All right. Time for the weekly Train of Thought segment. As always, joined by my buddy from WFAN in New York and SNY, Sal Licata. Sal, how's it going?
Great. Great to be joined with you again here as we continue on through the weeks of the summer now. You must be loving this hot weather. Can't step outside for 2 seconds without sweating your rear end off.
It's a big problem. I'll say that. It's a big, you know what the problem is? The problem is you've got to just have a plan. Like, you've got to minimize how much you're going to be outside. unless you're at a pool or a beach.
Right.
And inside, you know, you just stay in the air conditioning. That's, you know, people say, oh, they do all this stuff in the summer. Yeah, I stay in front of the air conditioning. That's the summer. I put it on 63 and I sit in front of it.
Wow. 63?
Yes.
Wow.
That's my temperature.
That sometimes is insane.
Sometimes at night I go to 62.
What? I am about 10 degrees higher.
I got to be freezing when I go to sleep.
I don't mind it. Usually for us, it's like 68. And that feels pretty cold to me. I can't 63. Holy cow.
Yeah. I'm not fooling around.
I bring my jacket next time you invite me over for a barbecue in the summer.
I try to keep it like a meat locker in here. So obviously the only story anyone cared about, it seemed like over the weekend, was the Rachel Nichols, Maria Taylor brouhaha that the New York Times broke. I wrote about it in Wednesday's Train of Thoughts. And I found a lot of things interesting, and I think there's a lot of layers and nuance to it, and I don't think it's a pretty straightforward story. But I will say, the fact that ESPN thought they would be able to cover it up is what I find amazing, because this happened last year. And if not for someone leaking it to the Times last week or whenever, nothing would have happened. Rachel Nichols, this ESPN knew about this last year, and Rachel Nichols was allowed to work the NBA Finals. Now it gets leaked, so she's not allowed to work the NBA Finals. It's the whole thing is just bizarre.
It's a mess, and I do think that it starts with the company who allows this and, as you said, tried to cover it up. I'll tell you, you know, and obviously I'm paying attention to the story. How could you not? If you're on Twitter or, you know, whatever, you
can't help business.
I mean, it's right. I mean, it's in our faces. I'm turned off by the whole thing for both of them, for ESPN. I mean, the fact that they're pulling shows, they're letting hosts dictate who they talk to, who they don't, the whole thing. I'm not just talking about recently. I'm talking about from start to finish of it. The fact that they didn't nip it in the bud. I don't, you know what? As a sports fan, I don't care about rich, egotistical anchors. I want the games. And the fact, and I'm not even a huge NBA fan with the Knicks out of it, especially, but I want to focus on the NBA Finals. I don't care about Maria Taylor and Rachel Nichols and what's going on with the ESPN. I'm sorry. So it becomes too big a story about them. Rachel Nichols said it right, well, you don't want to become the story. Well, guess what? They have become the story. And I don't think anybody, whether it's ESPN, Maria Taylor, or Rachel Nichols, I don't think anybody comes out as somebody you could root for and necessarily, you know, they think that you know, you want to get behind in this situation. I just don't care. Give me the game.
Once I read, I mean, and I just want to be clear, when I say cover up, I don't even know if they, I don't necessarily know they were covering up, but they just decided not to address it and they were hoping it would go away. And then boom, here we are. You know, it was 4th of July weekend. I'm trying to stay off Twitter. I'm trying not to pay attention to anything. And someone texted me that story at like 9 o'clock in the morning. And when I read it, I knew it was going to be enormous because there's a lot of things here. You have Rachel Nichols saying what she said. You have the fact that someone taped her and sent it to Maria Taylor. Then you have the ESPN didn't do anything about it for a year. And now what I'm surprised about is the story was crazy enough when it came out. But since then, ESPN, like pulling Rachel Nichols off the jump for one day, they pulled her off the NBA Finals. A layer in this, another layer that I wrote about, you know, you can make, what's interesting here is this. Last week, somebody leaked to Andrew Martian in the New York Post that Rachel Taylor's contract was up in a couple of weeks, 3 weeks, I think. She turned down $5 million last year when it was offered to her. They claim she wanted near Stephen A. Smith money, which is $8 million a year. And now ESPN, because of COVID and cutting people left and right, they're offering $2 to $3 million. That was in the Andrew Martian story.
Right.
Now, do
and
I
that
think...
The first, that was the first thing that came out, right? With Maria
right,
Taylor's
that
contract.
Was last week. Yeah. Right. Now, do I think someone, I'm not saying this was Maria Taylor, but do I think someone from Maria Taylor's camp or Maria Taylor backer or fan
100%.
Saw that, got pissed, and then leaked the stuff to the Times? You know.
Of course.
And her contract, now she's hosting NBA Countdown, which she did last year as well during the finals. Her contract, if the finals go 7 games, her contract ends before then. So who knows? And then the other thing I realized, it's a mess. ESPN has so many people for NBA. Like you hear, like they have Maria Taylor and Rachel Nichols. Doris Burke does sidelines, but for the finals, she calls the games on radio. But they have Cassidy Hubbard. They have Ramona Shelburne,
Malika Andrews.
Yeah, like the whole thing, and ESPN's NBA coverage when it comes to studio has always been a complete mess. I mean, they had the Bill Simmons, Magic Johnson show, then Michelle Beadle. That was a disaster. Then they went to they named Rachel Nichols and Maria Taylor, rotating hosts of the show in 2019. Who has rotating hosts of a studio show? Like, Kurt Menefee doesn't take off 3 weeks during the NFL season, and Kevin Burkhardt does it's bizarre. Everything about it was bizarre.
Also, again, I think that, I mean, the salaries, forget about the numbers, which I just, they'll never add. As somebody who's in sports media and wants to get paid as much as possible, those numbers will never compute to me. It doesn't make any sense what they make. But as a sports fan, I mean, we're in the media, so maybe it's more juicy to us. As a sports fan, would you care? Do you even watch pre-game coverage? I mean,
I watch some if I enjoy it, but I don't watch ESPN. If it was TNT, I would watch it because I like those guys.
And even those guys. I love Barkley like that, and that's always been my favorite show dating back for years. But even that, I'm not making a point to watch every night. I mean, I'd rather watch the game, and if I happen to have it on before the game, sure, halftime you get to see it, maybe a little post-game, but I'm not seeking it out. And I even know when you come over for Football Sunday, I watch some of the pre-games more so than you. You couldn't care less about the pre-game stuff for the most part. You know, for it's about the fans, and we're in the media, so maybe there's a little more interest for us because it's part of our job. Fans, I don't think, give a darn about the pregame stuff and who's hosting and who's not. Just give me the information and give me the game.
And the shame of it is that Rachel Nichols and Maria Taylor are both very talented. Like, they don't need this. I mean, this is, you know.
Agreed. It takes away from both of – look, it's nobody's fault. I mean, maybe other than ESPN. I don't think that it's Maria Taylor's fault, Rachel Nichols. You know, you could – I mean, there's blame to go all around for everybody. But now, will you ever be able to look at either of those two again without thinking of this? That's how big this
has gotten. Right. Well, that's what ends up happening. That's the problem. They're known for this now, and that's a shame. It's really – and who knows what – you know – people are saying Rachel Nichols is going to lose her job. Again, why didn't she lose her job last year? Why now? It's absurd. And Maria Taylor, you know, she may, you know, maybe she feels like she got burned by ESPN. Who knows? You know, that story by Marchand could not have gone over well with Maria Taylor, obviously, saying that, you know, she turned down $5 million a year. I don't blame her for being pissed that was leaked. She has every right to be.
And I'm sure that was an ESPN thing's a mess. Doing, obviously. You think about it.
Well, who knows?
ESPN did that, so then they fight back.
You don't know. Yeah. Who knows? Who knows? The whole thing is a mess. That's all I know. It's a mess. It's crazy. And then Adam Silver weighs in. I hope this doesn't distract from the NBA Finals. Too late.
He said that?
Yeah.
Oh, I missed that. I hope this doesn't.
Something like that.
The fact that even the commissioner will be talking this.
Well, ESPN said they pulled the jump and they pulled Rachel Nichols. They want the focus to be on the finals. Well, it's not happening. Sorry.
I think it would have been more on the finals if they just let the show run. By pulling it, they made a bigger deal of it.
Right. I agree. And she did the show. Rachel Nichols did the jump Monday, but they pull it Tuesday. Again, makes no sense. All right.
And when did they make the decision to take her off sidelines? I mean, that's another aspect.
Over the weekend. After the story came out. Because she did the sidelines last year. Crazy. Two baseball things. You might have a different take, and I don't know. I don't understand why people are so upset about the All-Star game uniforms. It's really not something you should be worried about. It's just a stupid uniform for a stupid game that you shouldn't even be watching. Well, I know they're ugly. I got it. Okay, why you can't care this much about the stupid MLB All-Star game uniforms. The amount of people I've seen go off about this is absurd.
I think it's more filler than anything else. I really don't. As somebody who grew up, and I know you and I are big baseball fans, it's an East Coast thing at this point. It's a local thing in New York, especially. But as somebody who grew up a huge fan of baseball and loved the All-Star game back when it meant something, National League versus American League, there was an interleague play. It was fun to watch the uniforms on display. Your Mets team out there, or Yankees team, whatever team, wearing their uniform. And the All-Star game, it was kind of a cool visual. But even I don't care that much about it. The uniforms are ugly. I get it. Ultimately, like you said, the way the game is now, you know, the only complaint is really that we're getting old and it's not the same as it used to be. Other than that, does it really matter? There are much bigger issues in the sports world, specifically in the Major League Baseball world, that you can complain about. So I think it's just filler for, hey, I got to get through a segment on the overnight. Let me throw out the uniform thing. And this thing stinks. Let's see if it sticks and maybe get a call or two.
I don't think I've watched the All-Star game since like 1989. I'll tell you what. Once they had interleague play, the All-Star game was completely useless. Right. I mean, I probably haven't watched an All-Star game in 15, 20 years. It's not real. It's a fake game. Oh, and you know, and here, the last one might have been, you know, the best was the year when Torrey was the manager, I remember, from the Yankees, and they ended the game in a tie.
Yeah, Seelig called it a tie. I don't know. And then they decided
the whole thing. Yeah, like, how can you care about All-Star games? You just can't. The last thing with baseball, because this is one of your pet peeves, and I got major issues with both things. I have major issues with that we're still doing runner on second base in extra innings. I thought that was because of COVID. Now that COVID's over, you're outside. And then the seven-inning doubleheaders. Why is baseball still doing this, and why do they always make bad and dumb decisions?
So here's my problem with this, right? I get what you're saying. I think that that's somewhat of a separate issue, the runner on second in extra innings. And for the record, I don't even mind that as much. The seven-inning straight-through doubleheader, you get it. I understand why it was put in place last year. You can't complain. Just get me the games and move on. But this year, maybe to start the year, was put in because they didn't know how it was going to play out, right? But now you're bringing fans back into play. As you said, outdoors, there are basically no restrictions anymore. So the idea that you're going to play seven innings to limit the time at the ballpark, that doesn't make any sense. And then the kicker is, not only are they playing seven-inning doubleheaders, they're doing it with a split gate. How can you justify a split doubleheader, day-night doubleheader, two gates, when the whole reason, and play them for seven innings, when the whole reason was that seven-inning doubleheaders would limit the amount of time at the ballpark, limit the risk and all that stuff, and get out, get in, get out. That's it. Now you're splitting the gate, which, by the way, I don't have a problem with. You want to split the gate? That's your right, especially after losing money last year. But how can you then play seven-inning games? You're charging full price, full admission. You're splitting the doubleheader, which goes against the whole reason why there's seven innings to begin with. So there are many different issues, the rule changes and all that we could debate until the cows come home. But that is non-disputable. That is disgusting what Major League Baseball is doing to their fans, scheduling split gate doubleheaders and still playing them at seven innings. There's no reason.
But see, to me, this stems from last year with what was stupid was, so if you play 18 innings, you get COVID, but if you play 14 right. innings, you don't get COVID. It was the stupidest decision back then. Don't give me this getting in and out and less time at the ballpark. 14 innings, 18 innings. COVID doesn't care about how many innings are being played.
That's true.
And then they continue it this year, which is ridiculous. And now they're going to charge fans for two separate games
and play seven
for seven-inning games. It's that sport, it's amazing how they do everything wrong.
How does Manfred not answer to this? I mean, all the simple question is why. Rob, you put this in last year and you could not it, and you're right. I mean, does COVID discriminate against 18, four extra innings throughout the course of a doubleheader? But maybe there are other reasons.
And you can't tell me that Rob Manfred, in the middle of the season, like we're taping this, it's July 7th. If Rob Manfred wants, right now, today on July 7th, he can sit there and say, no more seven-inning doubleheaders, no more runner on second. We're going back to regular baseball. Because they did the sticky stuff in the middle of the season. So right. There's no reason why they can. Now, maybe you have to vote on this stuff with the Players Association and the Players Union. Maybe that's a factor in this. But I find it hard to believe you can't change that in the middle of the season, but you decided to make sticky stuff and throw people out of games and make pitchers strip on the mound in the middle of the season.
I mean, so, think about the equivalent here. What are we just going to start? Well, why not play five innings, speed up the game? I mean, we're going to start playing three quarters in the NBA or in the NFL. Think about what they're doing.
No, we're not, because it's only baseball. This only happens with baseball. There's
it's
no
ridiculous.
Other sport.
The fans have to hold them accountable. And now I know it'll never happen, but they should be boycotting these games. How can you pay?
Well, then you're getting crazy. No one's boycotting a game.
Well, the doubleheaders, they should. I mean, are you going to pay full price to go to a seven-inning game? I mean, why? It's a
I wouldn't pay full price to go to a regular game. I mean,
that's
what
a good
am I doing? Sit there with these animals in the stands drunk and throwing things and droplets flying everywhere.
That's a fair
please,
point.
I'll pass.
Yeah.
All right, Sal. Appreciate it.
Thanks,
have a good
Jimmy.
Week. All right,
you
take
too.
Care. All right, my thanks to Sean McDonough. Really enjoyed speaking to him for the first time here on the SI Media Podcast. Love that Bill Raftery story. If you enjoyed the interview and you're not a subscriber to the SI Media Podcast, hit that subscribe button. And if you like this episode, feel free to rate and review. It helps tremendously. And if you missed any previous episodes, we had Chris Long on last week. Maybe you missed it over the 4th of July weekend. He was great talking about some current NFL topics and some lighter things as well. Jim Ross from AEW Wrestling, legendary play-by-play man for WWE. And John Oran, 2 weeks ago, were on the pod. John Wertheim, 3 weeks ago, Stu Gatz from The Lebtard Show, 4 weeks ago. If you missed any of those, go into the archives and check them out. All right, we'll see you next week right here on the SI Media Podcast. Stay safe and take care.